Michigan Field Hockey Cast 3.23. National champions? Not quite. But holy softball, some pitching in baseball, and hey, what are all the Michigan alumni doing in the NHL? Stick around to find out. Being the hockey cast, or supposed hockey cast, I guess we should probably start with some hockey. And the most relevant hockey, at least to Michigan fans lately, is field hockey. Alex, did you watch the game on Sunday, or even the game, I guess, on Friday, which was the semifinals, which probably was just as crazy of a game, and then the national championship game on Sunday?
I did watch the Sunday game.
You did? I saw the highlight of the ending of the Friday game, which is, I don't know, field hockey shootouts, or I guess they're called like penalty strokes or whatever, are interesting because like it's almost like soccer more than hockey, right? Because in soccer you take a shot from a dot, whereas in hockey you skate in and then there's a bunch of dancing and a move and everything.
Yeah,
I find that kind of interesting because then you see the person taking like sort of one swing almost. But it went in for Michigan, so they played on Sunday against North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Which seems a little, I don't know, I guess the top seed just hosts, or maybe they just always go to North Carolina because they're really good.
I don't know. I don't know off the top of my head.
Okay.
I figured you were the one with the field hockey notes. So.
Yeah. Well, did you have any thoughts about it? Like there, because I have found some interesting takeaways, but I want to give you a chance to throw something out there that like grabbed your attention.
I think the one interesting thing that I find, I don't know, odd, is that, like, the net is basically, like, one of those walls you hit tennis balls off of.
It's, like, not a net.
Well, yeah. Like they score, cage. They score, and the ball comes rocketing right back at you. I mean,
it's the goalie.
There's
in the
no
back.
Twine in there to... I mean, it goes in and out as fast as... It's like when, you know, the hockey player shoots from the blue line and hits the post and boom, right back out. You know, and you don't even know it went in.
Good dunk,
you know, off the back.
The,
yeah.
A dunk that hits the back rim.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that was interesting. Did you think the Michigan held their own or maybe even outplayed Carolina to a certain extent?
It seemed like it.
It seemed like it to me. So we'll preface this with, like, we're not field hockey experts. I don't try to claim to be. I've been to a few games at Michigan over the years, and I've, like, you know, watched a couple on TV and in the Olympics. I'm sure you've done something similar. You said you called a game.
I did call one game, yep. I didn't realize, by the way, how low scoring field hockey normally is because
yeah.
Michigan and North Carolina both score in the first, like, 5 minutes. And I was like, this reminds me of the game I called, because it was literally, like, 12-0. I mean, it was...
Wait, you called a 12-0 game?
It was ugly. It was...
But that's like a season's worth of goals.
Let me pull up what that game was.
Yeah, I mean, it's more or less low scoring. I mean, but when you think about hockey... And
then I went down the schedule, and all the games were, like, 1-0, 2-0.
Well, so that was...
Okay, it was 8-0 against Michigan State. That's the game I did.
Well, maybe State sucks.
No, they were number 24 in the country at that time.
Wow.
Michigan was number 9. I mean, it was a demolition. They did not belong on the same...
Well, that was one of the notes I had, is Michigan, up until Sunday, had given up 9 goals, like, on
yeah,
the season.
I know.
That seems insane. In anything.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like you're talking about, and then they both score in like the first like 8 minutes, 6 minutes of the game.
It was very quick.
And
yeah.
Michigan gets the own goal, right, where the girl gets in.
Yeah.
So I had to look up some of the rules. The interesting one is you can't shoot outside the solid line, like the big arc, which, okay, that makes, I don't know if it makes sense. Like, it's part of the rules. It was an interesting adjustment as to why people don't let it fly a little more, but, you know, now that makes a ton of sense. But the other thing that I thought is, so when you get... Michigan won in shots, or they had more shots, 11-8, and shots on goal were 8-7. So they not only like had more chances to score, but they like it seemed like they controlled the ball too. But they went 0-for-4 on penalty corners, and I don't really know what an acceptable penalty corner conversion rate is. Seems that 0-for-4 is suboptimal, especially given that Carolina went, I think, 2-for-5, maybe 3-for-5, which is maybe it's just you have a good shooter. But those things seem ridiculous. Like, you get everybody in the net, right? And then everyone puts on their face goggles. And then there's just almost like a firing squad where you have these people running and the bullets just coming through.
Yeah.
I mean, that's insane.
It's definitely is not for the, I don't know, the weak, I guess.
The faint of heart?
Yeah.
And then as the play goes on, you see the players throwing the glasses away, like during play, like, oh, I don't need this anymore. I don't know. I guess if I was playing, I'd be like, yeah, I don't really want to get hit in the face ever. But I thought that they seemed to hold their own. They seemed to control play. Carolina did have a few chances that they converted on, but Michigan seemed to like win a lot of battles in the midfield and control the ball, moving it up and down. And it wasn't like they were, after the first couple minutes, you're like, okay, I guess Carolina's just going to press them to death and we're going to be stuck here for the rest of eternity. But that's not really how the game played out. And they seemed to find a way to break the press and get out of it. Those like loft balls are interesting.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if that's a good thing or not. I was trying to figure out, and I couldn't get down the exact science of, like, when you'd want to play a ball in the air versus when you're not allowed to. But, yeah, that seemed a little different than other sports. And then I thought the cool thing was they rallied back. They're down 3-1. I was like, this is going to get out of hand. Maybe it ends, like, 5-2 or 5-1 or something. But they make a big stop on a penalty, I think, and a penalty corner, I guess, is what it would be called, to stop it from being 4-1. Come down and score and score again. And at that point, I was like, dude, we might do this.
Yeah, those two goals were scored when I was at dinner, and then we got back to watch the end there.
And you're like, what happened?
Well, I could see him in the distance, but okay. When it went to 3-1, I was like, yeah, this is probably not happening.
Yeah, but they did come all the way back, and they had chances. And so that's the other interesting thing is when it goes to overtime, and all of a sudden half the players leave the field.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, similar to NHL overtimes and such, or at least regular season where you'd go 3-on-3. And then it just seems like, how do you even move forward? Like, you're just kind of passing the ball. You don't want to turn it over. And then that one pass that goes from, like, the right D to all the way to the left D, and the one girl from Michigan gets her stick on it, and if she can control it anymore, I mean, it's a walk-in, right? Like, she's, like, coming in, and the ball goes off her stick, and I was like, oh, my gosh. How insane would it be to win that way? But they give up another corner, and then, which was the right move. I thought when on the replay, it was like, yeah, that's probably a penalty corner, I guess, the way what the rules were as I was like Googling them and looking them up, and then you start to figure a couple things out. But so it's kind of a bummer. It would have been nice to convert one of those penalty corners or two and maybe, you know, win, so to speak. But I thought they played really well. Also, the game is like interesting. Like when you start to understand some of this stuff. And it took like an hour and a half. So a full game goes an hour and a half. Like what other sport? Not even soccer does that. Like isn't that the complaint? No one wants to go to 4-hour football games. Oh, this basketball game lasted too long. All the timeouts at the end. Blah, blah, blah. I mean, field hockey's done by like 8:30 and it started at 7.
I definitely enjoy quick games.
Okay. Well, I think I could watch more of this. The issue is like sometimes the scheduling for this sport is suboptimal. Like Fridays at 3 are not something I'm probably going to be able to do consistently.
Field hockey also starts really early in most normal years.
The
first games are normally in mid to late August.
I mean, that's fine. Great. You're not bothered by other stuff.
Which was always our problem because it was a prime sport that we could have new people call.
Sure.
But by the time the new people were ready to go out and call their first game, the season was over. Like, it was done in early October.
Being WCB.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was our problem in calling it.
But the timing actually works out
soccer
okay.
Soccer goes about a month later, so soccer ended up becoming sort of the sport we would have new people call.
But, like, the timing of that is actually perfect for to follow it because you don't have like college football hasn't started yet and the NFL hasn't started yet. And you can DVR your Tigers game if you're still watching them in August or whatever. But the time of day for me was like, all right, if you guys could play it, you know, weeknights at night, this is something I might be able to do. So anyway, especially if they're good like that, I thought it was fun. It was a worthwhile investment. I mean, you came within overtime of a national championship. Pretty solid. If you ask me,
shout out to Washtenaw County, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
With, I believe it's, what, 7 of the 28 players on Michigan's roster from Washtenaw County High Schools. Yep.
Wow.
There was a really good article by Arya Gerson, formerly of The Daily, written a few months ago about that and about how Michigan's success as a program really has come from the fact that Washtenaw County is the powerhouse of field hockey in the state of Michigan. So
is Michigan a powerhouse state of field hockey?
Not really, because the thing is that Washtenaw County is one of the only places it's played in the state.
Yeah.
A lot of high schools don't have it, but it's flourishing in this area, and so it's become a fertile recruiting ground for the program. So,
well, yeah, I mean, it's literally next
door. Well, and I knew several people in high school who played.
Were they good?
I don't know. I don't follow high school field hockey, but I just know they played on the teams.
Aren't you a field hockey scout? You say that you're a scout of all these other sports. That's like the running joke of the year, right?
But one of the players on Michigan's team, actually, her little sister took piano from my piano teacher.
Ah. So you have a personal connection.
Yeah, I know.
That's pretty good.
Well, so the funny thing was, the one field hockey game I did, I remember pulling up the roster and seeing her name and was like, wait a second. And
we used to play piano together.
Well, and her sister and I played a duet at a big concert in Ann Arbor about 10 years ago.
I didn't know you were a piano guy.
That was, yeah. I mean, I can play.
Yeah?
I'm not a superstar, but yeah. I took for about 5 or 8 years, something like that.
I feel like you're being modest. You're probably pretty good.
Anyway, yeah. A lot of local kids on the team, which is cool to see.
Yeah.
So, shout out to that.
And it's something that you can look and say, hey, this is something that they can do going forward. This isn't like, oh, we got some magical class, but, I mean, you're in a nice breeding ground.
Yeah.
Breeding ground, is that right? No.
Yeah, probably roughly. Not.
Roughly. All right. So, good job, field speaking, hockey. Kind of a bummer, but...
speaking of hockey, we do have some breaking news.
We have breaking news?
Yeah, tweeted within the last couple hours.
Oh, wow.
Maddie Beniers is expected to make the Team USA World Championship roster, and Owen Power is expected to play on Team Canada's World Championship team.
Are those surprises?
Well, because normally the people that make those are NHL players.
Well,
this isn't the U18s we're talking about. This is the World Championships.
Ooh, so does that say anything about potentially... that they would be NHL players.
Shocking.
No, I mean like next year.
Not necessarily, okay. But I mean it's tough this year because the World Championships always take place sometime in May.
May, right.
And so normally the players who play in that are from eliminated playoff teams who want to play. So or teams that didn't make the playoffs. But this year with the playoffs being later and people with COVID, I think the rosters will be slimmer, but it'll be more exposure.
Well, good for them.
Yeah.
Some high-end competition anyway. All right, I think that is that the first half of the hockey that we've gotten out of the way, and now we're going to go to the bat and ball sports.
Sure.
So we'll start with baseball, who we talked about last weekend. He's going to go to which a crazy wind series in by the lake in Northwestern, but didn't play Northwestern, and then they transitioned to going to Michigan State. Which okay, so I watched some of these games. Is that not the weirdest outfield? That I mean, I feel like that could be a segment in and of itself. But like, I mean, that's like
the Michigan State outfield.
Yeah, it's like the entire outfield is Tal's Hill.
Yeah, I've never been to that stadium. I've been to Sakya, but I've never been to the baseball stadium there.
Yeah.
So I can't give you an in-person report.
Did you see it?
I saw the stadium from afar. I did not.
No,
see
did you see
the
hill?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what are you supposed to do with that? This isn't like Tal's Hill. I remember watching the Mets go to Houston in, I think it was 2007, and Carlos Beltran, like the 16th inning, goes up the hill to make this ridiculous catch. And I was like, he just ran a hill to catch a ball. This is the entire outfield. And you know it's there in this one little area, and they took it out, by the way. But like, holy cow, this goes to center field. What is the purpose of that? Like, river embankment? Because like on the other side of the fence is the river, right?
There's I don't know.
That's what, according to Craig, that's what he said.
I think it would be cool if other sports were allowed to modify their playing facilities.
Put holes in a soccer field?
Yeah, just a pothole in the soccer field.
I guess if baseball players are climbing hills.
I mean, wouldn't it be interesting if the three-point arc was slightly different in every stadium?
Have you seen that commercial with the guy who does the sidelines and he gets like, disoriented or something, not sidelines, the fair and foul lines, and he gets disoriented.
I mean, it's kind of that way
meandering around the field.
It's kind of that way in college hockey because Minnesota is allowed to just have a different sized rink than all of the other teams
in the Big Ten. There are other
Olympic
rinks. Yeah, I mean, but at least that's like one of two things. This isn't like a weird little adaptation. Like, so are you saying that like the depth of the 3-point arc, or like that the court is smaller and the arc like cuts off?
No,
like
the arc is just longer. You know, it's just a larger. You're shooting from farther away.
Who would? Go
or maybe
to that
the
stadium?
Rim is 9 feet instead of 10 feet in some stadium. I don't know. It would be very interesting.
This sounds like Brian's rules for changing sports in the summertime. Do you remember when he did his like?
No, I don't.
He did
that.
Like multiple series on it, and it was like two pucks for hockey, and you're like, what? No, I don't know.
You ever play air hockey with two pucks?
I've played very little air hockey with one puck.
You play with a ball?
I haven't played a lot of air hockey.
Well, you should come over to my house, though.
Do you have an air hockey table?
Yeah.
Are you good?
Not really. I mean, it's one of those things that when you get that kind of novelty thing, you think like, wow, I'm going to do this all the time. But then
you don't.
You don't really, because it's not a novelty anymore, right?
That's true. Do you just beat up on your brother?
It's kind of like how if there was Chick-fil-A's in the area, I wouldn't go very much. Because, like, when I was a kid, it was like, if you were in the South, you had to go to Chick-fil-A. It was the only time to get it. But okay. Then if it's in your area, it's like, oh, I can do that anytime.
There are better chicken places?
Well, that's a discussion for another day.
Fair enough. So, we've discussed the outfield. We haven't discussed the games yet. Game one was Friday night as Steve Hadjer. Got it, right?
Yep.
Yes. Goes 6 innings, 1 hit, 0 runs, 1 walk, 13 strikeouts. Where's this been?
Well, the first 2 days, the Spartans didn't have a lot to swing at. We'll say that.
Yeah, spoiler alert for game two. But this is, I mean, this is the Hadjer that we were hoping
and
to
you
get.
Needed him to do that because Mason Erla was throwing.
Right, and that was another note Spartans. I had. Is he's the real deal, you think?
He's a good pitcher, no question about that.
Is he going to get a deal, you think?
He was on some preseason draft lists. I don't know where he is now on those lists.
But Michigan also kind of knocked him around because he gave up 3 runs, 4 hits, 4 walks. Maybe that was a little bit of his undoing too, in only 5 innings. He did have 8 strikeouts, but it's baseball now, so if you don't get 10 strikeouts, you suck.
Yeah, it was a good showing for Michigan's offense.
Yeah, and the bullpen also pitched well. Page and Weiss each threw an inning plus. Combined, I think they gave up a run, a hit, and 4 Ks. And I think the run was like was that a dropped pop-up or something like that? I think it was. It was error-induced anyway. So my question now is, like, after this, is Page maybe their second-best reliever after Weiss?
Maybe.
Because he's had a few good outings in a row now.
He is a solid arm in that back end, we'll say that. One note about the relief appearance is that Weiss got the whole 4-out save. Ooh. In this game.
You don't see those a ton. Well, maybe in college you do a little bit more, but Mazur, Burton, and Molfetta each get RBI knocks, and that's kind of what led to their 3-run lead, and then I think they added a couple late on a Mazur single for insurance runs to make it 5-1, but that game, I guess, was never real until in doubt.
Nope.
Game two, kind of similar. This was the Cam Weston show, where yep. 9 innings, a complete game, which I don't even know if that's legal anymore. I think Michigan had to sign a waiver at some point to say, hey, we'll just write it down as 8 2/3. But he gives up 1 hit and 1 run, no walks, 9 Ks. I mean, this is like you get this Hadjer and this Weston, and now you're thinking, I mean, Michigan's got a shot to make the Supers.
Well, also breaking news, Cam Weston has been named Big Ten Pitcher of the Week as a result of his performance.
Show me someone who did better.
And the Spartans got to give him credit. They did capitalize on that one hit. They got a double wild pitch and sacrifice fly to manufacture a run, but yeah. They weren't doing much beyond that. There was one runner that got on in the eighth, didn't get leave first base, and that was it.
I mean, this seemed like one of those weekends, at least going into Sunday, which, you know, we'll get to in a second, but was great pitching and timely hitting win World Series, right? I mean, that's the whole cliche.
Yep,
is
pretty
like
much.
If you can strike or you can get them out and then you get the hits when you need them. And that's kind of what Michigan did. They didn't, because they didn't tear the cover off the ball scoring a ton of runs, but they got with a few and then gave up pretty much nothing until Sunday. Because now we're finally at Sunday. And this was, Denner was, ouch. 2.1 innings pitched, 6 hits, 3 runs, no walks, only 3 Ks, and he wasn't around very long.
Not great.
And the bullpen stepped up in no way, as Beers and Dragani both get lit up for a total of 6 runs, 3 hits, 3 more walks. Just not great pitching on Sunday. They got 2 really good days, third day not really. The defense, I think, was a little shoddy, too, with a couple of errors that contribute to it. A lot of some free passes.
I will say that they did get the end of the game kind of back on track in terms of the pitching with Joe Pace and Logan Wood, you know, actually putting up a few zeros to...
Well, Pace had been one of their go-to guys throughout the season.
Yeah.
One of the first 2 or 3 guys out of the bullpen, but that's sort of why I was asking you about Page, is like, ironically, their names are similar, but is Page kind of superseding Pace, because Pace had set the pace for a while, it seemed, at coming out of the pen.
I think that you can't have set roles, that you have to be able to use whatever guy is in the right situation.
Mix and match, as they say.
For the moment, you know, I think baseball has really moved beyond the 8th inning, 9th inning type guys. Mm-hmm. What I will say is that with Pace, you're going to be getting a guy who's going to go for strikeouts, but is going to be vulnerable for the walk, right? Mm. So I would think that Pace, in some ways, is the guy to go to with inherited runners, whereas Page is the one you start an inning fresh with.
Interesting. I like that. That's good. On the offensive side, Obertop and Flores each had a couple hits and runs. But that was really it. Eight hits, two runs is what it is. Bertram did draw a couple of walks. Good for him. And the defense was, I think there was a couple errors in there. So now we can transition to the standings, which are
basically unchanged.
Yeah.
I mean, they're very similar to a week ago. With you still have the cluster, the three-way at the top, Indiana 23-10, Nebraska 23-11, Michigan 23-12, a full game back at the Hoosiers, a half game back of the Huskers, and now we're into these final three weekends where Michigan will face, you know, Indiana and then Maryland and then Nebraska to close it out. So this is a tough stretch.
Yeah, because so they're going to face the number one team, the number five team, and the number two team all within 3 weeks.
Yep.
So it's do or die now. And they host Indiana in this upcoming week, I believe. Is that correct? Friday,
correct.
Saturday, Sunday?
Yes, I will be doing the Friday game.
Doing the Friday game. 4 o'clock before yep. Culver's?
Something like that.
2 o'clock on Saturday. And Sunday's game is on ESPN2, it looks like.
Yep.
So
this is a big series. I still don't think you can go to Ray Fisher, but you can pay for low-quality streaming and support the team over the laptop.
Do they let you stand, like, in one of the areas along the sides?
You can stand along the railing, you know, out to the parking lot.
They don't chase you away there?
I don't think so.
They did that at softball. I walked over there a few weeks ago, and they were like, get out of here. And I was like, no, I want to stay. And then they host Maryland the next week before going to Lincoln.
I would expect this series to be a pretty low-scoring, tight game type series. I mean, Indiana baseball has been really good this year pitching. I mean, a team 2.83 ERA. Hmm. All three starters have ERA sub 3.5.
Jeez.
So this is a team that can pitch. They've got a great bullpen. They've got a great rotation, too. Hitting team batting average of .265.
Because they could hit a couple of years ago when Michigan faced them, I remember.
Yeah, they don't have a ton of power hitters. Cole Barr at 8 homers is the only guy over 5. But, you know, again, they as a team, they only hit .265, but opponents are hitting .194 off their pitchers. So
they could be quick games.
They quick games, low scoring. This is not one where you can afford to give up 10 runs and expect to sweep.
This is where walks will be key, I'm guessing, and errors and mishaps on base paths will not be tolerated for very long. You're fine with a 2-3, I'm guessing.
Yeah, it may not help you a ton for the actual winning the conference necessarily. I mean, you'd probably want a sweep to do that, but I think just continuing to maintain a solid record and, you know, just playing well, that's the...
Yeah, well, kind of the inverse, I guess I should say, of this is softball, who...
Well, let's say one more...
Do you have one more thing about baseball?
Yeah, I will say that D1 Baseball's latest bracketology is out today, and Maryland is now into the tournament picture. They were the fifth team.
Fifth Big Ten team.
Yep, they're the last team in D1 Baseball's projection. As of right now, it has Michigan as the second team in the Austin Regional, with third overall Texas, as well as Michigan, Miami, and Bryant are the four teams in that regional. Michigan is in the picture, Nebraska's in the picture, Indiana's in the picture, Iowa and Maryland, Big Ten with five teams in. So that's where things look at the moment.
Meanwhile, out in Minneapolis, the bigger yellow ball teams of Michigan and Minnesota played what was supposed to be a pretty tight, close series, I would say, and we anticipated that, hoping Michigan would at least win one, potentially two, and maybe on the upside of three. But Michigan looked really, really good, I thought. They win three of four, they win the first three, fourth game kind of fell apart a little bit, but that was impressive. Actually, you know, before we do that, we should talk about the midweek game. I completely skipped over that. But Michigan goes to Michigan State for one of the craziest games, softball games of the year.
Well, the midweek game was the runners in scoring position pain game, because Michigan left a lot of runners on, and all they needed was one run to win that game. And it just kind of became a staring contest, because MSU had no answers whatsoever for Alex DiRocco. And
what was her line? We should go over this.
Yeah,
this is
I'll
insane.
Pull it up.
It's 9 innings, first of all. So it's extra innings.
2 hits, 2 walks, 22 strikeouts.
22 strikeouts. So what, that's 5 outs, not correct, via strikeout?
Correct. And she only needed 129 pitches, which is pretty crazy for 22 strikeouts.
So that's the time where she's just sitting there like, are you guys ever going to score a run?
I mean, it was, once it got into the mid-innings, I mean, it was basically Michigan State is not going to score a run. This game could go 16 innings, and they're not going to score. It's just this game will end when Michigan scores a run.
And I think Lexi Blair had a nice
Well, so the other
day.
Story about that okay. is that I watched innings, I don't know, 4 through 8.
Yeah.
And then I went upstairs to get a drink. And then I come back, and Lexi Blair's rounding the bases after hitting that home run.
And you're like, I've waited this whole time.
Yeah.
But she had a few hits, and it took a solo shot for her to get Michigan on the board, because they were not going to score otherwise.
Yeah.
And then once that happened, it was done?
Pretty much. And so then they move into the weekend series right. against Minnesota. And, you know, the Gophers just really didn't have a lot of answers offensively in those first three games. I mean, the Friday night game, Megan Bobia was really, really good.
Yeah.
You know, 4 hits allowed, 1 walk, 8 strikeouts through 5 scoreless. And I really didn't agree with taking her out and going to Starocco in the 6th. I thought that Bobian was still solidly in command and there wasn't really a need for that. But Starocco came in and was really sharp. I mean, she struck out every batter she faced.
Surprise.
2 clean innings, 6 up, 6 down, and the game was over. So can't complain. And offensively, they did their job. They got timely hitting, 2 homers, Lou Allen in the 1st, and Julia Jimenez in the 7th. Carson also got an RBI double with 2 outs. So, I mean, that was how you win a postseason game, is that kind of dominant pitching.
On the road.
You know, timely hitting, big hits, and that's how you win. And that was the start of a phenomenal, phenomenal weekend for Julia Jimenez, who, by the way, also breaking news, has been named Big Ten Player of the Week.
We've had a lot of breaking news today.
I know.
We're only in segment one.
That night, Jimenez was 1 for 3 with that solo homer, and then she just followed it up Saturday with a couple just phenomenal, phenomenal games. Was 3 for 4 in the 1st game with 4 RBIs.
Well, they scored some runs in that game.
They did, and Minnesota went an interesting thing. So they have Amber Fizer, who's their ace, go into Friday night game, and Fizer is a pitcher who has a ton of experience. I mean, she was the number one when they made the Women's College World Series 2 years ago and
okay.
has pitched in some really big moments and is as good as anybody. And Michigan did enough to beat her on Friday. They go back to her Saturday for the 1st game, and Michigan just pounds her. I mean, quickly out of the game after just 4 innings, 5 runs allowed. And, I mean, it just wasn't very competitive from the get-go, where Michigan gets 1 in the 1st, 2 in the 3rd, 2 in the 4th, and then 4 more in the 6th, and it's just they're running away.
And it seemed like it was going to be a run game, or a run limit.
They were in the run rule territory, and then the 6th, things kind of run into a bit of trouble.
Well, they bring in their 3rd pitcher, right?
Michigan?
Yeah.
Well, no, Starocco runs into trouble to start the inning, partially due to fielding errors.
Okay.
And so then they have to bring Shara Schaefer in.
Right. Yeah, that's what I thought.
And but by that point, it was going to be tough to avoid the run rule.
Okay.
There were already, I think, one or two runners in and runners on with nobody out.
Yeah.
So she did her best to get out of that. And then they brought Bobian in to close it out to finish the game. And then, you know, the 2nd game on Saturday is just a similar story. I mean, Bobian really, I don't know if there's some competition going on with Starocco, but, you know, Starocco has the great Wednesday game, and Bobian came back and was just terrific all weekend. Great on Friday night, great again in the Saturday 2nd game, and that was the game where Minnesota led for the 1st time. They scored the 1st run, Michigan tied it on a Hannah Carson double,
right.
And then in the 6th, Michigan goes to work. They get the sacrifice fly from Lexi Blair. Basically, Minnesota's defense melted down in the 6th. Michigan got a leadoff runner on, then they tried to sack bunt. The runner reached, tried to sack bunt again, and I think it was thrown away. I mean, it was ugly there.
We're giving you outs.
Yeah. And so Michigan gets a couple runs there, and then Bobian just did the rest. And that Saturday win made it, you know, 3 games in that series. And because it's officially been announced, which we didn't know last week at the time we were recording, but it's officially been announced that Minnesota will not be making up those games with Wisconsin.
Oh.
As a result, Michigan could clinch the Big Ten last weekend, and they did. Those first 3 wins clinched them the Big Ten championship on Saturday night, And then Sunday, you know, I don't know what was going on there.
And there's, well, let's just, you can talk about that in a second, but there's no Big Ten tournament, as we talked about.
Correct.
So this is kind of, it's, this is what it's all to play for. There's not, you're not jockeying for position or anything in terms of seeding or matchups or anything. It's just about hanging a banner in this particular situation. And then,
I don't think they hang banners in, from the rafters at Alumni right. Field.
All right, hang him from like the bleachers in the back or something.
No, it's all about getting that the scoreboard. You know,
it's on the scoreboard.
Yeah, there's the Big Ten champions.
Can we put like a pennant up or something, or a flag? Hang a flag.
But anyway, yeah, the Sunday game, 7-3, they lose, and it, I don't know if it was, you know, they were distracted on Mother's Day or they were
our moms are here.
They were hungover from. You know, the championship the night before. I don't know what the story was. But
I mean, Minnesota's also a good team and can win a softball game.
Oh, yeah, no
question.
I was going
to say they could win a football game. That's not true.
I mean, I think the problem, or the thing that was rather striking was this was the first game all season where Alex Duraco showed some cracks. And
well, it's like you said, it happened at the end of her second game. Well, second game of the week, her first game against Minnesota, right? Is she started kind
of... She ran into a couple problems. And that game, you know, I think there were a couple things going on. Her command wasn't there. She allowed three homers, two in the first inning and then one in the second, which is worrying because that was her old enemy in past years.
Yeah.
But she just didn't have it. I mean, the pitches were not there. Her fastballs were up in the zone. The changeup was just hanging. And I think, you know, Hutch wanted to leave her in there to let her try to work through some of the problems and eventually just kind of relented after allowing, you know, 3 hits and 3 walks in 2 innings, 5 runs. I mean, it was time to make the move.
Yeah, there's at that point, there's no point.
And Sarah Schaefer was okay, but wobbly, and Megan Bobian was also not nearly as good as she had been. So that was what kind of reassured me about Starocco performing poorly, is that all of the pitchers performed poorly relative to the other games. Maybe it was just a team-wide funk. Maybe it was the Minnesota hitters figured something out. I don't know, but
it was also their 5th game in 5 days.
Yeah.
So
turn the page and move on. So not their best, but, you know, even in that game, again, Julia Menez had 2 hits, including an RBI. I mean, she was really, really good. So
you're getting depth hitting on this team. It's not just one or two people anymore.
Well, yeah. I mean, between Blair, Natrod, Allen, Bump, Carson, Jimenez, and then Voss/Essman in the DP role. You have really 7 good hitters. Also, we got to see some of the depth players this weekend. Kiki Thole got to hit a few times.
Oh, yeah.
And had her first collegiate RBI over the weekend. So that was pretty cool. But otherwise, you know,
but 3 of 4 at Minnesota. I mean, we would have taken that last weekend.
Well, I mean, rewind to when we were talking before Northwestern, and I said, you know, way back then it was take 3 of 4 from Northwestern, 3 of 4 at Minnesota, and you'll win the conference. And they did just that.
So can they host a regional?
Unknown at this time.
We're still unknown. That seems like we talked about they might need 2 to do it, or 2 to 3. And
I said 3 to 4.
3 to 4?
Against Minnesota, yes.
All right.
So, you know, the big question is going to be, what does the selection committee think about the Big Ten?
Well, how many teams are in?
Well, not many, right? Not many people do bracketology for softball, unfortunately.
But you probably do. Are you a softball scout?
I did softball bracketology a few years ago.
Did you really?
I did. I did pretty well. You. But there's this dude who does it online. You know, who knows how good he is, but it's just a decent, you know, look at what people are thinking.
Yeah.
And right now, you know, he's got Michigan in, he's got Minnesota in, but he's pretty light on the Big Ten at the moment.
So no Northwestern?
No Northwestern at the moment.
And, well, that should tell you something about what they think of the Big Ten then.
Well, you know, my argument is that in some ways, you know, I'm not arguing for a lot for the Big Ten. I'm not out here saying that Atlantic Hockey should have 2 teams in the tournament.
Not, you're here for 3, right?
But what I am saying is that this is a conference that the last time we had a real softball season had 3 regional hosts, 2 teams in the Super, and 1 in the Women's College World Series. Like, the Big Ten, it'd be one thing if this was 2015, but the Big Ten was coming off of its best season in over 10 years, just 2 years ago. And Minnesota that year was a really good team. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this was not like the Big Ten at its lowest point in our most recent reference.
And there's no question the Big Ten is hurt from not playing the SEC and the Pac-12, but I think that Michigan should have a shot to. I mean, it's basically, do you think Michigan is better than the eighth best SEC team? And I don't have an answer for that, but I think that...
I mean, they've lost six times.
They've played really impressively in the Big Ten. They've been really good the last, you know, 2 months since they came back from Florida especially. And they've got, you know, really good pitchers, and they're in a groove in terms of power hitting. I mean, I think they're a dangerous team. I would not want to draw Michigan if I were a team that is actually going to host. That's what I'll say. Now, Michigan's up to the sort of the 17, 18, 19 slot in the rankings, but the rankings obviously are not the selection committee. You probably need to get to 17 to host because Louisiana is going to be a top 16 team, but they can't host.
Oh, right.
So you probably only need to get to 17.
Well,
it's just a matter of whether they get there.
They have four games this upcoming weekend against Rutgers.
Needless to say, you can't lose any of those if you want to host a regional.
Do you think they will?
No.
Didn't you have something about last week about how Rutgers' team ERA is like 7 or something?
Rutgers is a very, very bad team. They, on the season, now sit at 8-32.
That's suboptimal.
Their team batting average is .218, and opponents are hitting .322 off their hit pitchers.
Wow.
Their team ERA is 6.56, and their team whip is 1.98. They're a bad team.
Are you calling any of those games?
I'm doing the Sunday game. The
Sunday game. So will that be your last WCBN call?
No.
Ooh.
I will be doing either the regional the next weekend or baseball against Maryland. So.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, we've run this segment a little bit longer than we intended to, but we will take a break and come back and talk about the extended Michigan hockey family and how they're doing as the playoffs roll around. Come, my lady, come, my lady, you're my butterfly, sugar, baby. Come, my lady, come, my lady, you're my butterfly, sugar, baby. Such a sexy, sexy, pretty little thing. This April bitch, you got me sprung with your tongue ring. And I ain't gonna lie, cause your loving gets me high. So to keep you by my side, there's nothing that I won't try. Butterflies in her eyes and her looks to kill. Time is passing, I'm asking, could this be real? Cause I can't sleep, I can't hold still. The only thing I really know is she got sex appeal. I can feel, too much is never enough. You always there to lift me up when these times get rough. I was lost, now I'm found, ever since you've been around. You're the woman that I want, so you know I'm putting it down. Come my lady, come my lady, you're my butterfly. We kind of collaborated on an idea of like looking at not just the NHL playoffs, but sort of what the Michigan players are doing, because, you know, there's a number of Michigan players that are sprinkled throughout the league, and some in the minor leagues we'll even get into a little bit to just kind of check in. But it seemed like a good time as the playoff matchups are solidifying and the year's winding down and the minor leagues are ending to just kind of take a look at all of the professional players that played at Michigan that are still continuing their career for money, I guess. I just sorted them in a different way, different ways. But we'll just kind of walk through the NHL players first and just kind of look at who they are, what they did this year, where their career's going, and any sort of thoughts or whatever on that. I had some notes, you had a few notes, and we can just kind of check in on those guys. And that way it gives, if you're a Michigan hockey fan or a Michigan fan and you want to watch some NHL and you don't really have a team or you're a Wings fan and they're not going to be in the playoffs, then, you know, you can look for different Michigan players and check them out. Because last year we had a couple guys pop up and have some good bubbles. So we'll start it off at the top of my list right now is Steve Kampfer, who I just keep laughing at because he played at Michigan from 2007 to 2010. Back when I was a student, he was, I think, a freshman and sophomore maybe when I was in grad school. And he's still on an AHL roster with the Bruins.
Yeah.
Kind of.
He bounces up and down.
He's played 20 games. I mean, that's like 40% of the season.
He was really helped by the Bruins' just avalanche of injuries to their blue line.
So eventually he was going to be called in.
Yeah.
He has 5 points, 2 goals, 3 assists. I don't have a ton of notes on him, but I applaud him for still being there because he was never one of those guys that was like, this is like a top pair defenseman who's going to be around the league for a decade, but he stuck it out and has had a pretty good career.
You know, he was one of those guys that, you know, just bounces up and down. He's kind of your classic NHL, AHL tweener. And, you know, I'm happy for him. He is the pride of Jackson, Michigan, where both my parents are from.
You have some, I was about to say, yep, you have family. Some ties.
Yep. And also was born in Ann Arbor, and I remember when he won the Cup back in 2010. Yeah, 2011 with the Bruins.
Right.
He brought the Cup back to the Ann Arbor Ice Cube as well as Jackson, so that was...
Did you go see it?
I did not, but I mean, that was the when the Cup came to Jackson, that was a huge story among like my family members that lived there. So I will always... You know, think of have Camphor for that reason. So
soft spot in your heart for him. The next guy on the list is Greg Patterin, who again, I'm still a little bit surprised he's in the league. 2009 to 2012 for Michigan, played a few years in the NHL. My note of him is he got traded to the Avs this year, so obviously I follow him a little closer, a little bit. He only played 13 games, but he was with the Wild. The Avs made a salary dump in Ian Cole, it seemed like, bringing in Greg Patterin. And it seemed like a weird move because I didn't think he could skate well enough to play with Colorado. Maybe their sixth defenseman. And that kind of wore out to be true as Colorado has had, I think they've played 12 or 13 defensemen this year. And he has struggled to get in the lineup when they've had that many.
I had never really heard of him, let alone knowing that he was a Michigan guy. I did not know that. So.
Your notes say, I don't recall ever seeing this dude play. So
nope. And I mean, he was there during the Big Chill, so I probably watched him at Michigan because I was at that game. But I don't remember him at that game.
He was on their team that lost in the national.
Yeah, which I also
game.
Watched. So I have seen him play, but I did not know he existed until a few months ago.
Yeah,
when I saw his name in the transactions.
More
but even then, I didn't know he was a Michigan guy until I saw him on this sheet. So
bigger guy, tougher guy, stay at home. Not going to go very far, but still in the league, still playing somewhere. Maybe even if it's. In the AHL. Third guy. All right, so this changed after last night. But JT Compher was great when he was here. He popped as a freshman, looked good as a sophomore, and really took off as a junior. There was hope and rumors that maybe he comes back for a fourth year, which might have changed that team a little bit. But he decided to sign with, I guess it was the Sabres, or maybe at that point he'd been traded to Colorado. He's played with the Avs for 4 or 5 years now. And he started off his career pretty well. I thought he'd get some power play time with their big three line of MacKinnon, Rantanen, and Landeskog, and even got, I think, up to 2C a little bit, getting some minutes and scoring some goals. Signed a, I want to say, 5-year deal or something like that for $3.5 million, which seems now to be a little bit overpaid because the last couple of years hasn't produced quite as much. But got probably the biggest goal of the season for Colorado last night in Vegas on a redirect in front. A great pass from Alex Newhook. And he's just become that kind of a player. He's probably not going to be a 2C anymore. 3C is probably up in the air. But you mentioned probably bottom six type of a guy. He's got, before last night, he played in 45 games, had about 14 points, got his seventh goal last night. But he blocked a ton of shots on the PK. They're big PK at one point, and that's just kind of who he is. I think he's going to be a bottom six guy for years to come. I don't know if he's going to get a huge payday again, but probably a player that we're going to be watching in some capacity in the NHL for the next 5 to 8 years.
And Compher's a lot like Tyler Motte in that both were guys who were high-end offensive players in the NCAA level, but have adapted their game to basically become defensive players in the NHL.
Yeah. Yeah, Mott's later on this list. He hasn't, I don't think, had the success that Compher's had. Compher probably had... I mean, he's put together a decent career. It's just kind of... the last couple years have been not as promising as the first few were. The next guy that we have written down is Zach Werenski. This guy is a puck-rushing defenseman who was really one of the first guys at Michigan, at least in the analytics era, where he was going forward with the puck and made a ton of plays. Started as a 17-year-old on that team that finally made the tournament again after they'd missed it for 4 or 5 straight years. He's had a curious year with Columbus. Only played 35 games, 7 goals, 13 assists, been injured. The analytics don't love his defense, but his offense can be elite. So maybe he's just a bad fit in Columbus?
I mean, what I'll say about Werenski is that he's a really, really talented puck-rushing defenseman, very talented offensively, one of the probably 5 best shooters from the defensive position in the league. He had that season a couple years ago where he scored 20 goals in 60-some games. I mean, he's in the 98th percentile over the past three seasons in finishing among defensemen. So he can shoot, a talented passer, and I mean, his style is a lot of fun to watch in the way he's able to roam around the offensive zone. And I mean, he definitely meshed on some of those good Columbus teams. I mean, this year was tough. He was injured, also injured to end the year. And, you know, Columbus just didn't really have a lot of high-end playmakers. I mean, it was definitely not as fun for him playing with the guys they had now compared to that one season where they had Panarin and Duchesne. And,
yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot of questions for him moving forward because he's still a really young guy. I think he's a 1997 birthday or a late 96 birthday. So he's still very young, and he's got 2 years until he's an unrestricted free agent, but it's unclear what Columbus is doing moving forward. They just fired their coach. Yeah, his defense partner is Seth Jones. It's unclear if Seth Jones is going to be part of the team long term. It's unclear if Werenski. It's not clear where Columbus is going. Yeah. Are they reloading? Are they rebuilding? Not sure what's going on there, but he's a very, very good player, and he's a very valuable player. If he hits the open market or is on the trade block, there will be a lot of interest. He's a very good player.
Andrew Cogliano is next, and speaking of guys that just like won't go away, Cogliano played at Michigan in 06 and 07, was a high-end offensive guy when he was here. They had definitely had some talented teams back with like the Hensick and Porter crew. He's in Dallas. He's been there for a while. I feel like he's only played on a few different teams. You don't really hear a ton about him because he doesn't score a lot. 5 goals, 6 assists, 11 points this year, but he's played 52 games, which is almost all the games, or maybe all that Dallas had played, because I know that they'd missed some and had some issues, but has pretty much become a staple in somebody's bottom six.
He bounces around, finds a role, and Cogliano is one of those guys that fits the kind of team he's playing on. You know, Dallas has always, at least in recent years, has been a pretty defensive team, and I mean, he made the Stanley Cup final last year on that team.
Yep.
Plays with Blake Como on the penalty kill and just knows how to carve a role for himself. He knows what he's going to do, isn't going to score a ton, but is definitely a useful player, and he's managed to parlay, you know, a long NHL career.
Yeah, 12 to 14 years right now in that
yep.
range. Dylan Larkin, this is, I assume you will have takes on him. He played 1 year at Michigan, was awesome. It's too bad he didn't stick out one more when they got Kyle Connor, and that team would have been probably extremely high end. They were still really good, but he's in Detroit, got drafted by Detroit, has been there for what, 5-6 years now.
Yep.
And had a decent year, but maybe not as good by his standards. 9 goals, 14 assists in 44 games.
Well, Larkin peaked statistically in the general stats in 2019 when he had the 70-point, 30-goal season. The underlying metrics suggest that nothing much has changed. It's just his shooting percentage has gone way down, which has reduced his points. Also, the team, especially this year, tightened up everything, and they just sort of shrank into the, well, we don't want to be as bad, so we're just going to lose 2-1 as opposed to 5-2. And so, you know, in a very, very starved for offense system, his numbers declined. Also had an injury to end the season. You know, at his peak, Larkin is a really good two-way player. Probably not a number one center on a championship team, but the ideal number two on a championship team. He's the captain of the Red Wings. Is probably one of the only guys on the roster that has a long-term future with the franchise. Would love to see him bounce back and have a strong year next year. But he's a guy who can do a little bit of everything.
So you
and
think
a great, you know, a great team guy, great in the locker room, is a leader, all that good stuff.
You think he'll be around for the rebuild?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. Will this guy be around for the rebuild? Luke Glendening. If you would have told me, when he was at Michigan, I think he started as a walk-on. And he started playing as a sophomore, I believe, and eventually became captain, also played in the Big Chill.
Yep.
These are some guys that are dating, we're dating ourselves here, but I still have yet to figure out how he's been in the league for the better part of 10 years. He has 15 points, 6 goals, 9 assists, 54 games, so he doesn't miss games. But how? I mean, if you watched him play at Michigan, he wasn't bad, but I did not think 10-year career.
Well, Luke Glendening does the things that coaches like. He's one of those kinds of players. He wins faceoffs, which coaches value a lot more than stats people. I mean, he's always been one of the best faceoff guys in the league. This year, he won at over 60% clip towards
That's pretty good.
Towards the top. Allen can play on the penalty kill as a result. You know, he was a favorite of Mike Babcock when Babcock was in Detroit. He's become a favorite of Jeff Blashill. He was a favorite of Ken Holland, the old general manager. And
so
Iserman,
he's made friends with the right people.
Iserman's kept him around because his deal, you know, he was still signed. Now I believe he'll be an unrestricted free agent after the season. I don't know if he'll be brought back now, but I think someone will give him a contract because, again, sort of the old style thinking in the league, and that's what a lot of GMs and a lot of coaches still believe in, is the things that he does well. And he's a good guy by all accounts, good in the locker room, and a hustle dude, a gritty guy, and those are things that sort of the old cliches love. So that's how you turn a limited skill set into a long career.
What did you call him in your notes? Luke Grit Denning?
Yeah.
All right. John Merrill, this guy was high-end at Michigan, first-round pick. I forget who he was with. I think the Devils to start. And he was a very, very good defenseman when he was here, played 3 years, probably a year or two longer than people thought he would. But now he played for the Wings for a lot of this year and is going to get a chance to go to the playoffs with Montreal. He has 5 assists, 5 points, so no goals, and he's played 47 games, played a ton of games. You have talked about how good a defenseman he is.
I mean, he's a guy that, you know, does one thing, and that is he can defend. I mean, he's one of those guys that
you need to do that.
He's one of those guys that when he's out there, absolutely nothing happens.
Hooray!
Nothing offensive happens and nothing defensive happens. And so, you know, he was on Vegas before the season or last season, and Vegas, they like their defensemen to really
to
be involved. And yeah. So he didn't really fit there, and he was an unrestricted free agent. And again, the Red Wings in the offseason decided they were just going to be more respectable and lose by 1 goal instead of 4. And so he was a guy to fit that plan, right? The Red Wings wanted to suck the life out of the game, and Merrill fit that. And I thought they sold low on him at the deadline, honestly. They only got, I think, a 6th-round pick when I thought there was potentially, I don't know, that if that was all that was out there, I would have kept him, frankly, because I think he was a useful guy in Detroit. So he goes to Montreal, and he's just there now. I mean,
he gets to go to the playoffs anyway.
Yeah, I mean, he's a third-pair guy that does one thing, and that's not the worst thing to have.
Another defenseman, probably the opposite of John Merrill, is Jacob Trouba, who was at Michigan for 1 year in 2013, the year they did not make the tournament for the first time in forever. Was very ballyhooed, I would say, when he came in and went to Winnipeg and kind of blew up a little bit. And since then has gone on to the Rangers, gotten a lot of money, and hasn't done quite as much. 2 points, 10 assists in 38 games. This year, what happened?
Well, so Trouba was a high-end prospect, coming out of the USNTDP. He was in that super defenseman-heavy 2012 draft where 8 of the top 10 picks were defenders. He was one of them at 9th overall to Winnipeg. And, you know, in Winnipeg, he was always on the edge of being traded because they had cap concerns towards the end of his time there. And, you know, he got to be there through sort of the peak of the recent Jets, was on that really, really good 2018 team that made the conference finals. And, I think he got overvalued in Winnipeg. The combination of playing on that team and still being a former top 10 pick got his name around the league, I think, higher than it deserved to be. And that offseason of 2019, when P.K. Subban was moved as well, he was one of the top defensemen on the market, and Winnipeg got a haul for him. They got a really good return, including Neil Pionk, who's become, I think, a better player than Trouba, ironically. And New York shelled out to get him and paid him a huge contract, 7 years at $8 million a season.
Yikes.
And in New York, he's been a fine player, but I think he's a second-pair defenseman, and I think that you don't want to be paying a second-pair defenseman $8 million a season. The analytics actually liked his year this year a lot more than they did last season. I didn't really see that in my eye test review of him. He's a guy that can do a little bit offensively and defensively, but again, I think he's a second-pair guy, not a top-pair guy.
Well, the next guy we're going to go on to is another defenseman.
Well, he only played,
also with the Rangers, played one
game.
One game. Well, I have it written down. He scored 13 goals. I don't think that's right.
Yeah.
I think I miswrote that down.
Smashed Gerald Sittler's record there.
Jack Johnson. He was on the cardboard cutouts, right?
Yep.
Over at Yost earlier this year. He was probably as prominent a Michigan hockey player for a time. Was like a top, what, three pick, I think. And by, I believe it was Carolina, then traded to the Kings. He was something when he was here. And his professional career has lasted a while, clearly, as he was still in the league this year. But unfortunately, he's sort of more become known for some off-the-ice issues with his family. And
his family was unfortunate.
Issues. His dad was...
Yeah, not great.
Yeah, and started one of the worst traditions in Michigan sports. And but, you know, to Jack's credit, you know, has kept his career going, made back some of his money, and maybe not what he used to be, but he was still there at least this year for a game.
Johnson... kind of, unfortunately, in recent years, became known in NHL circles as kind of a joke because teams kept signing him inexplicably, despite being probably one of the worst players in the NHL. Our good analytics friend, Jay Fresh Hockey, famously loves Jack Johnson for ironic reasons. So that was kind of the attitude towards him, especially in analytics circles.
Like one of Crosby's like really good friends or something?
Yeah, well, he played on Pittsburgh last year, and so he was just a guy that in recent years has just kind of bounced around from team to team.
Yeah.
But it might be at the end of the line this year. I mean, he only played one game. I think he was injured, but you know, he's only in his early 30s, but I just don't know how much more value he really provides at this point. But credit to him, had a long career.
The last New York Ranger, and again, I was surprised this guy's still in the league. He was also on a cutout at Yost.
Yep.
31 games for Phil DiGiuseppe, who has a goal and 7 assists. I don't know if I've ever seen him play professionally.
Yeah, I haven't really either.
He played at Michigan, was an okay player, more offensive than defensive forward, scored some goals, but... When he was here, he never jumped off the ice to me as, oh, I'll see you in the NHL. And he's been there now for a few years. He played here from 12 to 14, so he's been around in the league for 6-7 years now, or playing professionally anyway.
Yeah.
But made it for half a season this year, so good for him.
Fourth liner that bounces around. It's pretty much all there is there.
So this guy did not start the season in the NHL, but now, based
on... Did.
Did he?
Yeah.
From game one?
Yeah.
Okay. So Josh Norris, who played a season and a half at Michigan and then had an unfortunate injury, otherwise that year could have ended a little differently, I think, potentially. Is he a top 5-3 Michigan alumni in the NHL right now? Because he's a straight-up rookie, 15 goals, 18 assists, he has 33 points in 54 games, and he is just getting started.
He's in the conversation for top five. I don't think he's better than Werenski or Pacioretty personally. I don't think he's better than Connor yet. And then he's kind of in that group with, obviously, Hughes having a down year, which we'll get to, and then Larkin obviously having a down year. I mean, I think he's around there. I mean, Norris has had a phenomenal season for Ottawa, 33 points in 54 games, and he's shown off his shot, which is a real asset. They use him as a shooter on the power play as opposed to a puck mover on there, which speaks to that, especially on an Ottawa team that sometimes lacks finishers. But the biggest thing is he's been really good at both ends of the ice, been really good defensively and really good offensively, has centered a line at times with Brady Tkachuk and Drake Batherson that is kind of the beginning of the future of the Ottawa Senators franchise. And, you know, It seemed impossible at the time that they would get their value back for Erik Karlsson, but between him and Tim Stützle, who they got from the first round pick,
wow,
they got their value back.
And then
it's
so.
Very rare you see a superstar, and he was a true superstar at the time. It's rare you see a team that trades a true superstar win the trade, which is something that Buffalo may be staring down with Eichel right now. But they did that, and Norris was only a first-round pick who, you know, had only been around a little bit. It didn't seem like the kind of blue-chip prospect that you make a trade around, but he's lived up to it. So shout-out to him, and I think if Stützle can become a first-line centerman like his number three overall slot would suggest, then Norris is the perfect number two centerman on a championship team, at least what he's tracking towards in terms of his development at the moment.
More than Larkin?
I think he's a very similar player to Larkin.
And I remember Norris as a freshman, the only full season he played here. That was the year that Michigan lost to Notre Dame yep. in the semifinal. They used him on a lot of defensive draws.
Yeah.
And so he's not just a scorer, but nope. he also plays really well in the defensive end. And, I mean, that's just something else that's going to add to him. Like you talked about being a number two center, which is something that you have to do there. Zach Hyman is in Toronto. Zach Hyman's a very interesting guy because I remember when he flipped from, I think it was Providence, to Michigan, his first two or three years, I was looking for him to break out and didn't really do a whole lot, stuck down on the third and fourth lines. His fourth year, his senior year, he sticks around and just explodes and becomes unstoppable. That was the Larkin year. I think Alex Kyle was on that team. You had the Mott and Comfer making. So they had an offensive scoring team, and Zach Hyman was basically the spearhead of that team.
Well, and Hyman, for his first 3 years at Michigan, did not produce at all.
That's
and
what then, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, and he's popped off, and now in the NHL, he has become a really good player. And
he has 33 points this year in 43 games.
I mean, Hyman's thing is that he is the glue guy. He is one of those players that just brings a team together, brings a line together. He does a little bit of everything. I mean, he's another guy like Glendening in terms of doing the things coaches love.
Is he a bottom six guy, do you think?
No. He's a top line guy.
He's
going to play. I mean, he played on one of the three or four best lines in the league, and he will in the playoffs.
Think that's true going forward?
Well, so I don't think he's his skill obviously doesn't match Matthews and Marner.
Right.
But he's the guy that brings that line together.
Okay.
Because when you have two great offensive players, you need someone who can crash the net, who can retrieve the puck in the corner,
yeah.
and who can win races and dump-ins, and that's what Hyman does. He is the glue that brings that together. And when he went down with that injury a few weeks ago, I mean, that was very scary there for a minute, and thankfully he's going to be ready for the playoffs, it looks like. And I think his stats, yeah, is probably the result of playing with those two guys, but he makes those two guys better too. And there's going to be a lot of interest for Hyman in the offseason. He's going to be an unrestricted free agent. He's 28, going to be 29 in the summer.
So he's probably going to be looking for a payday.
He's going to be looking for a payday. It's understood that he wants to stay with the Maple Leafs. He's a Toronto native. His father worked in Markham, a suburb of Toronto, and he grew up in the Forest Hill neighborhood of Toronto. So he wants to stay with the Leafs. Who wouldn't want to keep playing with Marner and Matthews, obviously? It's just a matter of can they come to a financial agreement. But he's a great player, and I hope him the best, that he does the best in the playoffs.
Tyler Mott is a guy we've referenced a few times already. He is in Vancouver, came up with the Blackhawks, was at Michigan for 3 years, really blew up in that third year on the CCM line of Connor Comfer and the M being Mott. He has 6 goals and 3 assists, so only 9 points, only played in 24 games this year. He had a really nice bubble, I thought, last year. Vancouver made a bit of a run, winning a series or two, and he was finding himself on the score sheet a few times, but it hasn't fully translated into this year.
This has been a bad, bad Vancouver team, and he's been hurt like anybody on that team. But I still like Tyler Mott a lot. Again, he's a very similar player to Comfer in the way he's transitioned his game.
So he's a better defensive player? Because that was not his forte at Michigan.
Well, and so his underlying metrics at even strength defensively aren't great. Where he shows out, he is one of the league's best penalty killers.
Okay.
He is a phenomenal penalty killer, and that's his niche. The problem is you don't get as much interest. Zach Hyman, for example, and it would not be as good on a team that isn't very good, right? Sort of role players who do certain things really well look better when they're on great teams.
When you're playing with Austin Matthews.
Yeah. So, Mott was a revelation because his team was on a run. And then now that his team, no one cares about him, right? Chris Draper would not have been the same player if he were not on the Red Wings for 20 years. Like, it's just, if you are a role player on a great team, you become elevated.
Robert Horry.
Yeah.
So this is going to be the interesting one. Maybe this is even the one that brought this whole thing together. But Quinn Hughes played at Michigan for 2 years, is in Vancouver, signed, played a couple games at the end of Michigan season a couple years ago, played decently well in those few games, and then last year just blew up, was in contention for the Calder, I think.
He was the runner-up, I believe, in that award.
And this year it has not really gone the same way, and there are Vancouver-ish reasons for that too. He does still have 3 goals, 33 assists for 36 points in 49 games, and Vancouver still has some games to play because they had an extended COVID issue. The thing that I saw that's interesting that I want you to touch on and then maybe expound upon even is that he was becoming more reliant upon the power play for his points this year, and his defense was also quite poor. And so is that a recipe for success, or does something need to change for him or for his team? It's a very curious couple of years for him.
So Hughes, I think, is interesting because his NHL career right now is following almost exactly the same arc as his college career. And
that's true.
This terrific first year, and his second year, his stats are exactly the same. And so if you were just reading the stats, you would think, oh, he's the same player. But this year, his point totals have been heavily skewed to the power play. His underlying metrics at even strength have plummeted. And anyone who watches him, it's just been really bad. And again, he's been hurt playing on that Vancouver team, and there's a lot of issues with Vancouver. They're just a terrible defensive team, and part of it is the styles don't mesh very well. Vancouver is a team that relies heavily on the cycle to create offense, which leaves their forwards deep in the offensive zone, which leaves them vulnerable to odd man rushes the other way. And Hughes, as someone who likes to roam the offensive zone, puts himself out of position as well.
Yeah.
And so suddenly it becomes bad like that. Also, the thing that has to be addressed is that last season Quinn Hughes was playing with Chris Tanev, who for almost a decade now has been one of the elite defensive defensemen in the NHL. They do not re-sign Chris Tanev in the offseason, and Hughes has played this year with Tyler Myers, who
is different.
I don't know who Hughes should be playing with, but he should not be playing with Tyler Myers. You know, Hughes is the kind of guy where he needs to be playing with somebody who can do two things, who is sound in fundamental defense and who doesn't turn the puck over. Mm. And Tyler Myers is none of those things. He's not a very good defender, and he's a turnover machine. Because the problem when you put someone next to a puck rusher like Hughes, who's a turnover machine, is that's going to put Hughes in tough situations.
Right.
You want Hughes, by nature of the way he plays, is going to put his team in tough situations at times and is going to put his partner at tough situations in times. That's why you need a fundamental defender to play with him.
Right.
You don't want the partner putting Hughes in tough situations. Hughes is already going to put the team in enough tough situations.
So this is a management coaching issue too.
Partially, yes. And so there's been so many times that Hughes has had to defend 2-on-1s and 3-on-2s and 3-on-1s because Myers is just a disaster. And that's where the elephant in the room comes into play, which is that when you watch Hughes, there are times when it does not appear he is trying. And, you know, just really poor effort defending, you know, where he's just waving the stick. And, you know, I mean, how many times he just goes down too early to try and stop Pat. It's been a horror show. And so I think the whole team needs to reset. It's unclear if they're going to bring Travis Green back as the coach, but they need to just, you know, he needs to just take a bath and, you know, let whatever happened this year run off, and then they need to find a partner for him. And I think there's no clearer example of this than what happened in the offseason with Toronto, where they go out and they get TJ Brody, and he has been the perfect match for Morgan Rielly. And Morgan Rielly is a very similar player to Hughes. They need to find the TJ Brody for Quinn Hughes. Hmm. Problem is, Ottawa needs that kind of player for Thomas Chabot.
Well, who doesn't? You know? I mean, in the way that it's the NHL's going.
And Vancouver having to pay Hughes in the offseason and pay Pettersson in the offseason aren't going to have a lot of money to find that kind of player. And so I don't know where they get that kind of player. But let's be clear here. Hughes is one of the 10 most talented offensive defensemen in the league.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of finding someone who can balance him out and getting him to buy in and getting the team to buy in. And that's the challenge for Vancouver.
Sounds like they have a few of those challenges in the upcoming offseason. So this guy is maybe the best Michigan player in the league. Max Pacioretty played 1 year at Michigan on probably the best Michigan team I saw, at least when I was in school. It was the Porter Kolarik team. He was the third guy on that line. Porter won the Hobie. They were number one for the majority of the year and lost in a Billy Sauer meltdown in Denver in 2008. But Patch was awesome that year. Went right to, I believe he went to the Canadiens.
Yep.
and has basically been very, very, very good since. He's having a great year in Vegas, 24 goals, 27 assists for 51 points in 48 games. He's missed some games, obviously, as you can see here, but he's the best Michigan player in the league?
I would say so, yes. I think Pacioretty is the most underrated player in the NHL and has been for a while.
Just because he doesn't get the notoriety?
So, I'm talking, when I say underrated, I mean actually underrated. There was this long-running thing that in NHL circles that Patrice Bergeron was the most underrated player in the league, even though Patrice Bergeron has the most Selkies of anyone ever and is going to be a Hall of Famer.
Isn't he also on like one of the most famous lines?
And then after Bergeron was the most underrated player was Alexander Barkov, who's going to finish top 10 in Hart voting. No longer underrated.
Yeah.
I'm talking about someone who... And so basically the joke about that is they were so underrated they became overrated. or something like that, right? Like it just became... It lost meaning. Pacioretty is actually underrated. He is, you know, I think the top 5 or 10 sniper in the league. Such a good wrist shot. And you just look at his production. I mean, it took him a few years after leaving Michigan to really get going in the league. Didn't start till about 2011 or 2012 when he was a regular producer. But, I mean, you know, here's your list. 33 goals, 15 goals in the lockout shortened season, so that's about 30 over a full season. 39, 37, 30, 35, 17, 22, 32, and now 24 in a shortened season. I mean, that's 30 goals nearly every year, and he plays on a top five line in the league with himself, Stone, and Stevenson on a really good Vegas team.
Yep.
He can do just about anything in the offensive zone, and he scores like nobody's business, and he just doesn't really get talked about as an elite player. And sure, he's not Austin Matthews elite, but there are not a lot of better scorers than him in terms of pure sniping. And 24 goals puts him just outside the top 10 in the league.
I mean, that's really good when you can be one of the best, if not the best player, on one of the best, if not the best teams in the NHL.
He's not the best player on Vegas, Mark Stone is. But
you think Stone's better?
Yeah.
By a lot? Because of his defensiveness or defensive prowess?
I mean, he's a great passer, and he's got the defensive aspect. But Pacioretty makes Stone better, and Stone makes Pacioretty better. That's how great lines work.
Sort of like the Hughes thing you were talking about.
Yep.
Carl Hagelin is maybe one of the most favorite Michigan players of all time just because he played for 4 years, and everyone loved that he was from Sweden. It started the whole flags in the student section thing. He loved the Children of Yost before they were the Children of Yost. And Carl has not had an amazing NHL career, but he's still going. He's become more of a bottom six forward now. But he's won 2 cups in Pittsburgh. I think he played for another when he was with the Rangers. He's still playing on competitive teams. He was a great penalty killer here. I think he still is in the NHL. He only has 5 goals, 10 assists anymore, but that's not really his role in 55 games. But he's played in almost every game, if not every game, for the Capitals this year. He'll be in the playoffs. I wouldn't be surprised if Washington made a bit of a run. And Carl's been kind of a fun Michigan player. He hasn't played on the same team with ultra consistency. He's been traded a few times, but has always found himself in the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, Hagelin is another guy who's just a role player on really good teams, and he knows his role. He plays good defense, and he's a tremendous, tremendous penalty killer, and that can get you a long, long way.
So hat tip to Carl. Next is probably maybe the most productive Michigan player in a year is Kyle Connor. He came in and played 1 year, 15-16, and easily won the Hobey Baker despite not getting it. His only competition was JT Compher, and he got almost twice as many points as the guy who actually won it, I believe. Connor was pushing 80. Maybe he's in the mid to high 70s.
Good old Jimmy VC.
He scored pretty much at will that year from a number of different ways, has more or less transitioned seamlessly to the NHL and has continued scoring goals. Maybe not the defender that you would want as a forward, but that's not over his role. He's dangerous on the power play, just puts the puck in the net, and is starting to build a very nice career up in Winnipeg.
I mean, he's a terrific shooter, and, you know, he's building a career not unlike Max Pacioretty. He's going to need to bring his defense up a little bit to get to Pacioretty's level.
At some point,
but, I mean, this is since, you know, he's played now 4 years in the NHL, full years, and 31, 34, 38 goals and 23 in this shortened season. I mean, that's, he's been automatic 30-plus goals for 4 years now. It doesn't do a ton outside of that, but he's still a decent passer, plays, all, you know, really good offense, and you're not going to find many better shooters than him.
He's played in the playoffs a few times, too,
and better and skaters than him, too. So.
Yeah, he skates really well, but he scored in the playoffs as well. This isn't like a guy who just is going to load up in the regular season, but he scores when it counts. The other guy is his teammate, who was also not quite his teammate at Michigan, who left the year before he got here. Andrew Kopp played here for 3 years, was a captain. Wasn't great at anything that I remember specifically, but could do almost everything, and was the 1C at Michigan. He's probably going to be a bottom six center, but has kind of like that bottom six role that a lot of Michigan players are carving out for themselves. He's also in Winnipeg. He's been there his entire career. He has 15 goals, 24 assists, 39 points in 53 games. So not too bad.
Andrew Kopp is an Ann Arbor native, we should note.
Yep. Skyline, right?
Went to Skyline. He also,
I think he was their quarterback.
He was their quarterback. He also went to Emerson Elementary and Middle School,
where
I was.
Where did you go?
Yep. He was 5 years older than me, but his brother Tyler Kopp was only a year or two older than me. So, you know, got to love the local guys. And I like Kopp a lot. He has found a good role in Winnipeg, and this has actually been by far the best year of his career. 39 points is a career high by 11. And the season that he had the previous career high, he played 82 games. This year he only played 54. So,
but when you get that in a shortened season, or even out, not even in a shortened season, from your third or a guy on your third or fourth line, like, you sign up for that in a heartbeat.
Yeah, his defense and the underlying numbers has decreased a bit, but in the normal years he was a very good defensive player. I still think he is from the eye test, and you know, his production's gone up, and I mean, he's now getting a lot of minutes in Winnipeg, and you know, that's a team that has continued to be very competitive for playoff. We'll see if they are this year, but
should be a high scoring series against the Oilers.
It should be. And he's going to have a tough job in terms of containing the opposing offense there.
Yeah, well, that'll be a storyline to watch. That's it for the NHL players. We'll just quickly run through the guys in the AHL. There's only a few. And you, if you hear something that you want to mention, I don't know a ton about these guys other than what they did at Michigan. Most of them are four-year guys. A couple of them, I'm kind of surprised they're still around. But Joe Ciccone played here for 4 years, is still with the Texas Stars. He's played 24 games this year, has 8 points. Will Lockwood, who was Michigan's captain up through last year, has played in 24 games with the Utica Comets. He has 11 points. You wrote down a note saying you think he might get a shot.
He'll get to play a game or two in the league at some point, I think. I don't think he's going to have much of an NHL career, but I think he'll get a shot at some point.
Griffin Luce has played 18 games for the Rochester Americans. That is not something I overly expected, to see him having a pretty decent AHL career.
I mean, it's early, and you need, well, you know, recent college guys to stock.
I guess he's a, you know, he's a defender. So yeah, like you said, Kevin Lynch is still in the league. He played here, Michigan, from 10 to 13. He's with Laval Rocket. I didn't even know that was a name.
Yep, that's the Canadiens AHL team.
I see. He has played 7 games still. Kevin Lynch was here. He also played in the Big Chill and in the national title game that they lost in 2011. Cooper Marody, this guy left after his junior year, in some ways carried that 17-18 team to St. Paul in the Frozen Four, scoring tons of power play goals. He has 21 goals and 13 assists for 34 points in 36 games. That's pretty good. He's one of the league leaders in the AHL. I think he did it a little bit last year, too. Does he have a shot? I mean, he's played a couple games with Edmonton.
It's getting to the point now where it looks like he's just kind of stuck as an NHL-AHL tweener, but it's not the worst place to be in the world. I hope he gets more of a shot in the future, but you know, he's a really good AHL player and hasn't really been able to cut it in the NHL, and that's a tough place to be.
Luke Martin's played a handful of games with the Texas Stars, doesn't have any points. Jake Slaker is also with the Texas Stars. He's played in 25 games, has 12 points, 2 goals. He's a guy that he's probably not going to have much of an NHL career if he gets a look, but I could see him playing minor league hockey for a while. I thought he always knew what to do with the puck and could do it. He just maybe couldn't skate at the highest end.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Brendan Warren is also with the Rochester Americans. He's only played 6 games, but he has 4 points. Hat tip to him. He was a senior here a few years ago, played 4 years, saw some things at Michigan, and is still in the AHL. So good on him. There's a number of guys still in the ACHL. There's about 6 or 7, 8 guys. The only one guy that I wanted to mention in there was Jacob Hayhurst, who was a guy I really liked at Michigan. He transferred in, played 1 year, was really fun to watch, has played 19 games with the Wheeling Nailers. Only has 8 points. Probably not going a lot of places, but I was happy to see him getting a little bit of minor league time at least.
Yep.
Anything else in the Michigan hockey alumni family?
Not really.
Next week, we will continue on and let you know what happens as the baseball and softball seasons, regular seasons conclude. And maybe we'll talk some tennis, and at one of these weeks we'll have to have you and Craig do a French Open draft.
It's still a little ways away for that.
We got a couple weeks, right?
Yeah, they pushed it back, so it's starting like the last couple days of May.
Okay.
But next week we can talk about the NHL playoffs.
Ooh, there you go.
Thank you for listening to Michigan HockeyCast 3.23. For Alex Drain and David Nasternak, come back next week where we'll talk about more sports.